is a very important figure, leader inside the Black is Back Coalition. This brother is the senior editor of the Black Agenda Report, who will discuss the role of money in political campaigns. Glenn Ford is a political columnist known for his astute observations and exhaustive research. Ford's presentation is expected to provide an uncensored and factual account of a long-term policy-making impact of the corporate financing of political candidates. A consistent critic of the Obama regime, Ford has published numerous articles on the financial interests that Obama's policies and initiatives benefit. So at this time, I would like to introduce to everybody Glenn Ford, Uhuru.
Power to the people. Now, I promise I'm only going to mention Obama's name maybe once or twice, because we at Black Agenda Report are Obama'd out. But mostly because we understand that this subject of Black electoral participation is much bigger than Obama. And because there have been vast changes that affect the efficacy, the usefulness of Black electoral activity in the past 40 years, and especially in the last 10 years. So I want to take a kind of historical overview in examining the role that the bourgeois control over the electoral process plays, not in general, like I think we're familiar with the general outlines, but how that affects Black electoral politics, the candidates that get thrown up in our name and that we wind up having to choose between. The rulers of the United States have always been property owners, and I'd like to remind folks that the first presidential election in the United States was participated in at that level by only 10,000 people out of a total population of 2.5 million, a half a million of whom were Africans. Now these rulers are situated mainly on Wall Street. They have always directed dissent into the electoral process because it is a rigged game and it never directly threatens their rule. But much of the Black struggle has been a fight to get in the game. And we've talked about this many times at Black is Back conferences, that there are basically two main currents of Black thought. And these two currents coexist often in the same Black brain. They coexist, but there is a push and pull and a conflict and a tension. And those two currents are, one, what I call the representationist current. And that representationist, you got to represent, actually wants nothing more than to see Black faces in high places, Black faces supposedly representing us in politics and in the economy and in the national culture. But this tendency does not give a damn about transforming society as long as Black faces are included in whatever goes on. The second current is self-determinationism, and that's us, everybody in this room. It's about building institutions and movements and consciousness in ways that express and that serve the African-American community, and that also means serving humanity, because African-American interests and African interests are humanity's interests. Electoral politics has at various times, and this has been throughout our history, seemed to fit the bill for both currents at different times. Certainly the representationalists and often the self-determinationists. We know that Malcolm grew to think that elections had some utility for Black folks in his last days on earth, that voting could be of some use to us in the struggle for self-determination, which, of course, is what Malcolm was about. This subject was one that was gone over many times back in the old days when I was young. And many here remember those discussions. They were quite heated and vital and probably our most stimulating intellectual era was when we were discussing what are we going to do with this potential electoral power. And so today we're kind of revisiting a subject that actually has been neglected over the past 40 years. And I'm so glad that the Black is Back Coalition is going to revisit this. Many black revolutionaries back in the day saw that we would have to, and soon, face the challenge, what to do with the black metropolis. Because in the 60s, it was becoming clear that this new demographic was going to change some very basic things about black life. But the cities were rapidly, in such a very few years, becoming black, that the national profile would be something that we couldn't have imagined in the 50s, that we would be the majority in so many of the nation's biggest cities and have a dominant, say, a very active plurality in most of the others. This new demographic phenomenon was a lot bigger than what we used to call community. When we said the black community, we really used to mean a neighborhood. And we were not talking about the city and what are we going to do with the city, since we now are, population-wise, the city. So it was a very different kind of meaning. And we did talk about it. But events were moving very quickly back in those days. And COINTELPRO and those other repressions by the state were causing deep disruptions on the black left and among folks who considered themselves to be nationalist. And those disruptions, which is a euphemism for murder, interrupted that conversation that we had started to have in the mid and going into the late 60s about how to build a black city, what to do when we're a majority. The question would have involved all of the functions of civil society. By definition, if you are the majority in the city and you're talking about electing your representatives to run the city, then you have to talk about all the functions of the city. You have to talk about education and neighborhood security and economic development, the whole bit. This is a huge conversation that we had not had reason to talk about before in our day-to-day struggles, because we didn't control the city. But here, this looming future was looking right at us. So we did begin to have this conversation, but it was interrupted and disrupted by the state, by COINTELPRO and such. So while the U.S. security apparatus had us, and I'm talking about those on the left and nationalists, in a state of disarray, the representationalists and the opportunists who wanted nothing more than to get into the game rushed into the electoral arena. And they quickly declared that elections were the only way to go, and that mass grassroots politics was passé, that the time had come and gone for that kind of stuff. And it was time to stop that. And there was a more sophisticated approach to politics, and it was voting. They basically were telling us that there was nothing worth turning out for in terms of masses of people except to vote for a black politician. And by the way, that's me. So what did those black politicians do when they achieved the mayor's office? The first thing that Maynard Jackson did in Atlanta was proclaim that his overall goal, his ambition as mayor, was to create a local class of millionaires. And he just said it straight up. Then, and this is his first action, he broke the strike of the mostly black sanitation workers in Atlanta, the same people that Dr. Martin Luther King had died attempting to defend only a few years earlier. Maynard Jackson set the tone for many of our worst black mayors. Now, it's got to be said that not every black mayor was as blatant a bourgeois operative as Maynard Jackson was. But the general behavior of black mayors in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and going into today was, in effect, quite similar. They did not have a plan on how to build a black city. I don't think they even thought in those terms. Most of them came to see their job as begging capital, as begging the money folks to come back to the cities. And to them, that meant white people coming back. So they enter office wanting the white folks and their money to come back. No sooner, that is, had black folks achieved the demographic feat of becoming majorities and dominant pluralities in so many cities when their elected representatives began trying to figure out how to bring the white folks back. Most of those black politicians didn't put it that way. They spoke in what I'd call general nationalist terms, and people accepted the rhetoric, but their actions were as beggars. Please come back and help us. Don't abandon us like this. Please come back with your money and we'll set a place for you. These politicians methodically traded the unused and vacated parts of the city to corporations. They did that as incentives for the corporations to come back. We'll give you the world if you just bless us with your presence once again. They knew, and any fool should have known, that most corporations demand that there be enclaves for their upscale white workers and all the rest of their business operations. And that is part of any investment deal. They don't just give you the money and say, we're not going to take a part of this city for our basically exclusive use. Some black mayors were shamelessly down with the whitening process in the cities. Washington, D.C.'s mayor, Anthony Williams, and he was mayor from 99 to 2007, he announced that D.C., which was the quintessential chocolate city, could easily accommodate 200,000 new residents. And everybody knew that he was not talking about new black people. Atlanta became the first major city to totally demolish public housing, which was, of course, 100% black in Atlanta. But other black-run jurisdictions were not far behind Atlanta. And so we witnessed what I think is the ultimate irony. The same class of black opportunists who had risen to local power through the blackening of America's cities presided over the demographic reversal of fortunes later on. They presided over the whitening of those same cities, and they did it by design. These were the collaborators in the methodical dismantling of black majorities and black electoral power in the cities, a process that is ongoing but by now inexorable. We can't stop that one. We're too far behind in the curve. The same people who told us that the only path to progress was through harnessing our demographic power. That is, they said it is through the strength of our numbers that we will be able to come to power and effectuate change. These same people, this same class of politician, were complicit in the erasing of that singular advantage that we had accrued. And now that demographic window is closing. We have allowed our chance to build the black metropolis to be squandered by the same class, and it is the very same people who abandoned the mass movement at their first opportunity back in the late 60s. That is a sin of historic proportions, and we should never, ever forget and never, ever forgive them for having squandered that historical opportunity. We collectively cut them all that slack and all that time, and they left us nothing from that now quickly bygone age of the black city. They are bankrupt in the eyes of history. Now, I'm going to be a little bit more direct at addressing the subject of money and electoral politics. I think that's another way of saying bourgeois monopoly of the electoral process. There are lots of places to go on the internet where you can find out that the two corporate political parties in 2008, the last presidential cycle, spent $2 billion on that dance. We know that Barack Obama spent, and this is just the official tally, more than $700 billion, and that McCain, and that McCain spent roughly half of that. But this is a conference of the Black is Back Coalition, and so we want to talk about, I want to talk about how all that election money, and not the 2008 money, but the whole process affects our polity, the black polity, how it affects the black political conversation. So I'm not going to make a kind of general critique. It is true that for more than two decades, our black misleadership class mayors have been selling us out. It's true that they have been eroding our demographic base, and it's true that they've been kissing the butts of every corporation that ever showed any interest in all, at all in coming back to the cities. But during the first few decades after the civil rights and black power movements, corporate America itself had not made any concerted effort to cultivate their own branded black political class in the country. They had not raised up a new crop of folks who knew all the buzzwords and were very consciously working towards a consolidation of corporate control in America. They gave us two decades in that sense of a respite. They were going around the country subverting and suborning and laying out all kinds of AstroTurf money with all kinds of other groups. They were subverting labor by setting up anti-labor groups that claimed to be labor groups. And they were subverting environmentalists by setting up actually corporate front organizations that claimed that they were environmentalists, and on and on and on. But they didn't do too much of that with us. And the reason, I believe, is that these guys were so racist, they didn't want too many black folks in the room in the cocktail party. They couldn't conceive of that kind of intimate relationship that you actually really do have to cultivate with these people who you're going to put out there as fronts for you. And they were just too racist to do that for a very long time. And they gave us a kind of breathing room. We didn't do much with it, but we were not subjected to the full force of their money politics for more than two decades. And that's until the mid-90s. In the mid-90s, an outfit called the Bradley Foundation, which George Bush calls his favorite foundation, and they have a bunch of satellite think tanks, and they decided that the ideal wedge that they could conjure up with their money between blacks and unions, and remember those are the twin pillars of the Democratic Party, they're supposed to be the twin pillars of the progressive movement, but we don't have any progressive movement, but the Democratic Party was enough. And so they realized that because black folks revere or say that we revere education so much, this was the place to go to put a wedge between blacks and especially the teachers' union. And it turned out to be a master stroke. They then decided to use their money with us the way they had used it with so many other groups. They decided to fund these, an AstroTurf organization to bring together a bipartisan pack of Republican and Democratic opportunists to toe the corporate line on school vouchers for private schools and later on for charter schools. And they found their young black champion in this search for a wedge. And his name was Cory Booker. And he was a first-term councilman here in Newark, New Jersey. They also found a whole bunch of other black prostitutes, but Cory was the shining star. And who are they? They are this same menagerie of old money billionaires, plus now the new high-tech billionaires like Mark Zuckerman and, of course, Bill Gates. And their project, and it was planned thoroughly at the Bradley Foundation and at their funded think tanks. Their project was to transform black politics right down to the precinct level in the inner city. And they, knowing that Newark was the quintessential chocolate city and was a not too big a morsel to chew, not as large as D.C. or Philadelphia or certainly Detroit, something manageable, they decided, and they had their star here, they decided to target Newark. Their initial thrust, and it's still a major thrust of those, is for the privatization of public education. But their larger goal, and this was always the strategic goal, was to raise up a whole new cohort of black corporate politicians. They have largely succeeded. All of those shining stars that they talk about so glowingly in the corporate media, you know their names, but and I promise not to mention our president's name too often. But they all come from that new class, and I mean that like the class of Harvard. This is the new class, graduated and assiduously cultivated and plied with money by these folks who would transform black politics. 2002 was their big offensive. This is when they kicked off this experiment. Most of us, of course, didn't know at the time that we were being attacked. That offensive started right here in Newark. It was Cory Booker's first run for mayor, and that was the starting gun. Mayor Sharp James, he didn't know what he was up against. He didn't realize that this was going to be a different kind of race, a different kind of race than anyone had experienced, because this was a new initiative from the folks who rule. Now, let me say up front that Sharp James was corrupt. Let me then say that corrupt is nothing new in black politics, and he was not uniquely corrupt. He's just corrupt. Sharp James also wanted to sell the city's water supply to a private company and anything else that he could have detached. There's nothing strange about that. He was quite ready to sell out, in that he resembled so many black mayors. But he was not a conscious soldier for capital or for capitalism. He was just corrupt. Cory Booker was another thing entirely. He was the real deal. He was their first graduate, Sigma Cum Laude, however y'all say that. And this was their first deep down in the ghetto foray into black politics. As I said, down to the precinct level, the place you got to go if you're going to elect a corporate guy as the mayor of Chocolate City. Booker was a political nobody at that time. I'm talking about 2002. But he officially, according to the books, spent $2.8 million in that 2002 race versus Mayor Sharp James's $2.3 million. Now, this is amazing. Sharp James had been mayor for 16 years. He was universally considered to be the most powerful black politician in New Jersey. I remember the Star Ledger published a list of, I think it was 10 of them, 10 people that they called the barons that ran Newark and northern New Jersey. And all but one of those barons, according to the Star Ledger, all but one of them were fantastically rich businessmen. The one, that baron that was not, was Sharp James. So Sharp James had access to money. Sharp James had been used to getting businesses to give to his campaign, but nothing like Cory Booker. Sharp James told me that he thought Cory Booker had raised $10 million. And I don't think that that's quite true. But it looked like $10 million because Cory Booker in his campaign got the endorsement immediately. And I don't mean just a mention on an editorial page. Got the active endorsement and active laudatory coverage from every corporate media outlet in the New York metropolitan area. And we're talking about people who would not give a damn about Newark since the riots in 67, or at least since the election of the first black mayor. But all of them were there rooting for Cory, and that was worth millions of dollars. We, and I say that because I was a part of those who were trying to beat Cory, we did beat him, 53-47%. That was only 3,000 votes. We said that he was working for the rich white man, and that seemed to work. But the right wing, the people that were backing him, they were actually quite happy. Remember, this was an experiment, and he had almost won. So that was quite encouraging for them. And then 2 months later, the election was in April of 2002. 2 months later, it was Congressman Earl Hilliard's turn in the Black Belt of Alabama. Hilliard was also running against nobody. That nobody's name was Archer Davis. He was just an assistant prosecutor in Birmingham. But here comes another tidal wave of money, new people in town, money that nobody had ever seen. Hilliard didn't know what hit him, just like Sharp James didn't know. Archer Davis spent $1.5 million, and this is Alabama money, $1.5 million on a congressional seat. Earl Hilliard, the incumbent, spent less than half of that, and of course, he lost. And then a couple of months later, in August, the big money crashed down on Cynthia McKinney's head in Atlanta. She was vastly overspent by another nobody, a former Republican named Denise Majette. The corporate media not only jumped in with all 4 feet like they had in the Sharp James race, but they made this a national contest. They told everybody, they sent their correspondents right down to Atlanta, and they told everybody that this was a battle between the old civil rights rhetoric of politicians used up, the spent force, and the new business-friendly black politician, the new breed. And that's how they framed that race. Majette vastly overspent Cynthia McKinney, and she lost. Bruce Dixon and I, at that time at Black Commentator, we did a study, and we concluded that Cynthia McKinney had won more than 80% of the black vote. A couple of months later, a white political scientist who was constantly quoted by the Atlanta Constitution did his own study, and he said that Cynthia won 86% of the black vote while losing the election as a whole. So Cynthia McKinney won the black election. Cynthia McKinney proved the opposite of what they had concluded, proved that a black politician who identified with the tone and substance of this civil rights kind of politics actually carried overwhelmingly the black constituency of the second most affluent black majority county in the United States, second only to Prince George's County outside D.C. So we have to think about, and I'll get back to this, we have to think about what is the nature of our defeat and what's the nature of our victory. How can we say that Cynthia McKinney was defeated? Not from a black viewpoint, she wasn't defeated. In black terms, she was overwhelmingly affirmed in her political stance. But her district was only about 52% black. and white folks turned out in great numbers. With the totality, the total effect of this 2002 series of elections, this appearance of money, was to send a chill into the entire Congressional Black Caucus. They had never seen anything like this. Here are these two nobodies knocking off two of their colleagues in succession, overspending them tremendously. And this guy, Cory Booker, almost becoming a mayor of Newark from a position of nobodies. And Majette and Arthur Davis joined Harold Ford Jr. in a kind of conservative right-wing bloc in the Congressional Black Caucus. That had never existed before. Never, never. But money brought that in. And so with this right-wing bloc and with this threat to every incumbent, that a race which used to cost you $150,000 or $200,000 to hold on to, which is why Congressional Black Caucus members tend to be older than the rest of the House. They stay in there longer. Now, some nobody can jump up and spend $1.5 million or $1.2 million and knock you out. And that put the fear, not of God, but of money in the Congressional Black Caucus. When we look at who gave money to Arthur Davis, what do we see? Remember, this guy is nobody, and from a backwater district in the Black Belt of Alabama. Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, the American Bankers Association. Who gave money to Hilliard? The unions. And that's the case with all of the Congressional Black Caucus. And if you add up the union money, you can get $150,000. In fact, you think of that as an entitlement. And that would have been enough to get you by, but no longer. So this threat from corporate America changed the behavior of the Congressional Black Caucus. And by 2005, the caucus had been totally cowed by the threat of being unseated by corporate money, by a black candidate backed by corporate money. So we're not talking about black-white situations. We're saying that these people had successfully infested our election races. What did the caucus do when it became cowed by corporate money? They became more corporate. And so by 2005, the Black Caucus was more in favor of a bill that would have changed the way cable operates in the favor of the telecom corporations, more in favor of that bill than the House Democratic Caucus as a whole. Bobby Rush used to be high official in the Black Panther Party. He got $1 million computer center for his district from AT&T, and that made him lead the charge for the telecoms interests. This is what we've come to, and in such a short period of time, remember, this is 2005, and the starting gun for their offensive was only 2002, and yet we have a totally changed Congressional Black Caucus. Another major change, and I've run out of time, but I already have an agreement with Nellie that I can steal maybe 5 of her minutes. Thanks. I was just affirming our previous agreement. Thank you. We used to have something called supermajority congressional districts, and 60, sometimes up to 70% black, and we liked that, and all the black politicians wanted their district to be super majority. The Democrats didn't like it. The Republicans liked it, too. But the Democrats didn't like it because they felt it was in their interest to cut up the black vote, which is a guaranteed Democratic vote, among as many districts as possible. So their ideal would be to have like 20% black votes in four different congressional jurisdictions. And that way, they'd only have to win maybe 40% of the white vote, and that guaranteed 20% of the black vote would give them the district. Of course, it wouldn't give us any voice at all, but it would give Democrats the district. And so they, over a period of time, prevailed. And we don't have any more supermajority districts, and most of our districts are in the low 50s. So here we have this additional change that not only are our candidates cowed by money and running after it, but they're speaking to an audience that is barely half black, and that's by design, and that's a Democratic Party concoction. Then the question, of course, becomes, what are we going to do about this changed environment? Are urban majorities are quickly becoming a thing of the past? Big money has entered our local political races bigger than ever before, decisively, in a decisive way. And corporate media has declared, after all these changes have been imposed on us, that the old black politics is dead. The system is thoroughly rigged to discredit movement politics. And it now claims that movement-type politics, and you know what they mean by that, people like yourselves, that movement politics are actually unpopular among black people themselves. I think that we need to think back to Cynthia McKinney's so-called defeat, but which I think was a great victory in Atlanta back in 2002. When the fact that she won 86% of the black vote was pointed out, not by us, but by a white guy, the white political scientist, and then quoted in the Atlanta Constitution, that thoroughly discredited Denise Majette in the black community. Black folks didn't even realize this, but they read the Atlanta Journal. They don't necessarily read black commentators. And Denise Majette quickly passed from the scene. She never recovered from that, from being exposed as not being the voice of black DeKalb County, but in fact being the white voice with only a rump black following. At a minimum, that shows us that in terms of our entrance into electoral politics, we do have the power to discredit the corporate chosen black politician. We may not win in these rigged circumstances, but we can say, you don't represent us. I don't care if you're in there, you see. And that is a worthwhile thing to do, to delegitimize the folks that they pay to represent them in our community. Brother Charles Barron, y'all know him, and he should be here this weekend. Brother Charles Barron won 28% of the vote in a Brooklyn congressional district against Hakeem Jeffries. The district was 56% black. Hakeem Jeffries spent $1.2 million. Brother Barron didn't spend enough to appear on the Open Secrets. He couldn't research it, so it was not a great deal of money. I think it was about $50,000, which came out to a zero. But he won 28% in a 56% black district. And if you know anything about Charles Barron, he didn't get any white votes. Negligible, not statistically worth mentioning. So simple arithmetic would tend to say that it looks like Brother Charles Barron got half of the black vote, 28-56. Sounds like exactly half of the black vote. So if for no other reason, and there are plenty of other reasons, we can say that Charles Barron succeeded in showing that Hakeem Jeffries is not the unchallenged black voice in that district. He only won half of the black vote. Half of the black vote he did not win. And that makes Charles Barron's race worthwhile. If we're going to play this electoral game, and we will, let's play it. I think we should play it by our rules. We are about black self-determination. We want allies in our struggle, and we want everybody to have self-determination. But what is most important to Black is Back is that the black worldview be expressed and heard most especially by black people themselves. To the extent that elections can serve that purpose, then they are useful to us. But we're not in this game just to play. We're in it for black power, and we're in it for social transformation. Power to the people.
Another brilliant presentation from Comrade Brother Glenn Ford. Glenn puts the Black Agenda in Black Agenda Report, y'all. Really laying out a really important analysis of the modern day form of neocolonial politicians and politics in this country. So following up, the next speaker brings a similar type of analysis and wealth of information to this discussion and to the coalition. Sister Conrad Nellie Bailey will share lessons from electoral politics in New York. As co-convener of Occupy Harlem, leader of the Harlem Tenants Council, and veteran community organizer, Bailey has engaged in fierce battles with New York City politicians and officials to win human rights and improve living conditions for the black community. Through radio broadcasts, forums, and blogs, she exposes the backroom deals and financial interests at work in the political interests. So once again, I want to welcome Conrad Nellie Bailey. Uhuru.
Thank you, everybody. It's a little hard going after Glenn, but I'll do my best. But I want to pick up on Glenn's narrative and talk about Harlem and electoral politics, because it is part of that same narrative that he just presented to you. And in this instance, it's a bit of a digression, because what we're going to talk about is the chicken coming home to roost for Harlem black politicians, because that's what's happening there. Unlike Maynard Jackson in Atlanta, who wanted to create a class of millionaires in Harlem, they were just fighting for the crumbs off the table for themselves and really sold out a historic black community. The People's Republic is not in Harlem, it's in Brooklyn. So I'm going to talk about the consolidation of corporate power and the final stages of Harlem's gentrification, electoral politics in Harlem's black managerial class, the chickens coming home to roost for the black politicians in Harlem. This is the new political reality, and Glenn talked about it. You got one man, one woman vote, right? And then you got $1 million. And it's the money that is being fed into these local elections that are now making huge differences. And it doesn't matter where the race is, congressional races, local state legislature races, the money is there. Congressman Charles Rangel, and I want to tell you this, this is my narrative about Harlem. Congressman Charles Rangel, as we all know, narrowly beat back a primary challenge for his 13th congressional seat. The money boys of the right-wing Republican Party took aim at Rangel, who milked the attack against him for all it was worth, better than to face the ugly reality of his total sellout of his constituents in the community of Harlem. It was the classic boogeyman scare, the right-wing Tea Party going after a righteous Democrat. Rangel, who has been in office for 41 years, faced a challenge from State Senator Adriana Espaillat, who, like Rangel, is in the pockets of New York City's powerful real estate industry. Espaillat received major contributions from the Super PAC campaign for primary accountability, pulled together by a pack of conservative Texas businessmen and financiers. Espaillat, who was born in the Dominican Republic and elected to the state senate 14 years ago, claimed he had no knowledge of who the donors were behind the Super PAC. The 13th congressional district was first held by Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was elected in 1945. And the now 81-year-old Charles Rangel, who defeated Powell in 1970. Now, the I want to say here, the demographic changes that have taken place that I'm going to talk about later has altered the makeup of the 13th congressional district that is no longer a majority black district, largely through forced displacement of blacks entirely, almost entirely, due to gentrification. Under new boundaries imposed by a federal court as part of the reapportionment process every 10 years based on the census data, the 13th congressional district has been extended into the Bronx, and more than half of its population now is Latino, Dominicans. It is not likely that another black will win the seat when Rangel Lee's office, just as African Americans have pushed for the black first, so are the Dominicans who are now pushing for the first Dominican-born congressman. There is another political reality for Harlem's black managerial class. What little influence and power the black politicians had imagined they had has now ebbed away. Forced black migration out of the city has diluted black electoral power in central Harlem, the center of black Harlem. Harlem's black political establishment didn't have enough political muscle in the New York State legislature to create a seat centered in Harlem and extended to encompass neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, and in Westchester County and the Bronx, which had significant black populations. Then there were behind-the-scenes hands of Governor Andrew Cuomo, who wanted a local resolution to the dispute. After all, the governor has his eyes on the White House. Obama's man in Harlem and beyond, the Right Reverend Al Sharpton, Al Charlatan, as he is called by some, but I won't be nasty here, a rehabilitated figure of national respectability, convened a meeting of the bickering factions. According to a story in the New York Times, Sharpton, who wanted to protect, in his words, a predominantly black district concentrated in central Harlem, which, by the way, is the seat of his own political power, arranged a sit-down of the warring factions at the Grand Havana Room, a member-only cigar club in a luxury high-rise in Midtown Manhattan. After 3 hours of a harangue, of haranguing these imaginations of their disputes, a deal was reached. Two congressional seats that would each include Manhattan north of 110th, which begins 116th, which is really Harlem's border, but also 110th. Its southern borders was agreed upon to satisfy concerns of Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz. All of these politics, many layers here, who confronted Adriana Espaillat for advocating a new congressional district that had a Dominican majority and one without a broader Latino population. The Times article reported Espaillat dug in his heels, insisting that he wanted what was due to the Dominicans. So they reached a deal, but the New York State legislature, of which blacks have little or no clout, nor do the Latinos, didn't approve of the deal. And so the federal court, a federal judge, stepped in, and she drew the new district lines. And so the new district line now includes Harlem, Washington Heights, and a small part of the Bronx. The new district is about 55% Latino and 27% black, although the district population of eligible voters is about 45% Latino and 34% Black. Rangel, again, in all likelihood, may very well be the last Black to hold the historic 13th congressional seat, Black as it has been for the past 45 years. Now, Central Harlem, which is Black Harlem, added 10,000 new residents in 10 years since 2003, a 9% increase in the population. Now, these are 10,000 new residents, 9,000 more whites, a 400% increase. Hispanic increased by 8,000, a 40% jump. While Blacks remained the majority with 60%, they lost 9,500 residents that produced an 11% decline. Now, that's the New Harlem. And that it is, in fact, as Glenn pointed out, a microcosm of what is happening across the country. Now, let's go back to the People's Republic of Brooklyn, because if you were in New York City, you followed the Hakeem Jeffries and the Charles Barron race with bated breath and just your eyes on the news and on the television news media and on the print media. And part of it was because the propaganda and the attack against Charles Barron surpassed anything that anyone has witnessed in the past 20 or more years in Harlem. It surpassed everything. It was a no-hold-bar attack against Charles Barron, and he, of course, I understand, will be here later, and he will talk about this. The propaganda and the attack were so dirty and so beyond the pale, they even put out a rumor that Charles Barron's campaign had been funded or donations received from the KKK. It was unbelievable. And because Barron maintained his position and did not bulge or did not back away from those positions and his policies over the years, including support for the rights of Palestinians, and you can imagine how that doesn't go down well in New York City, as it is throughout the country. Even Chris Hedges talked about how he had to leave the New York Times when he talked about the rights of the Palestinians and how he was blacklisted. So you can imagine what it was like for Charles Barron. And of course, Hakeem Jeffries fits the mold, the cookie cutter image of what Glenn just talked about, our man in New Jersey. You know, there's a prototype, there is a look that they're looking for. You can't be too Black because, I mean, you know, you gotta, as it was pointed out by Barack Obama's mentors, you know, he's, you know, clean cut, you know, not too dark, you know, you don't want to scare white people, you know. You know, we can deal with that. Hakeem is clean cut, you know, right color, you know, he can pass that paper bag test. That brown bag test, he can do all of that, you know. But most importantly, he can pass that Obama rhetoric test of the promise of change, which means absolutely nothing because his allegiance, his alliance is with that of the 1%, and that is Wall Street. Now, I want to talk about a couple of other things just in terms of what else is happened in Harlem, just to give you a clue about this mop-up stage, the final stage, stages of gentrification that is taking place in this once historic black community. In a recent headline story in the Amsterdam News, Herb Boyd, that many of you know, who's a journalist and a writer, had a front page story. Black-owned Harlem suffers another blow. And it his piece chronicled a list of black-owned businesses in Harlem that have closed over the past several months. Why? Because corporate America and the banks has a death grip on Harlem that will produce an even greater forced migration out of Harlem. Now, some of you may know about the black-owned Hugh Mann bookstore that had a national reputation as the largest black bookstore in Harlem, black-owned bookstore, not only in Harlem, but in the country. But it closed after 10 years in business because of a hefty increase in its commercial rent. In fact, the increase was raised up to $10,000 a month. That's right. I didn't say 1,000, but $10,000 a month. Okay, I thought I had more time. Sorry, I gave it up to Glenn. And then, of course, we have the famous Lenox Lounge, the famous Jazz Lounge. Its commercial rent shot up to $20,000 a month. And then, of course, as these box chains move into Harlem, and it will dominate the 125th Street commercial corridor from the east to west, from the Hudson River to the Harlem River, largely because of the rezoning of 125th Street, all supported by the elected officials in Harlem. Now, the average rent, just take a look at hear this. The average retail rent in the second quarter of this year in Harlem was $100 per foot, up 33% from $75 the prior year quarter, which itself was a 50% increase in retail rates in 2010. Real estate brokers are predicting that commercial rents in Harlem may soon reach $175 per square foot. The biggest commercial corridors are, of course, again, 125th Street, Frederick Douglass Boulevard, Lenox Avenue, as well as Sugar Hill and 145th Street. Now, I just wanted to say just a little bit more about the gentrification process has been ongoing since the turn of the century in Harlem. And if I could just have some time here, because I want to point out this notion of getting rid of blacks and poor people in Manhattan, out of New York City, because the oligarchy of New York City determined that it was not profitable to have poor people living on expensive real estate. And that has been the policy in New York City since the turn of the century. That has been the policy that led to deindustrialization and the confluence of fire, finance, insurance, and real estate that dominates the financial corridors of New York City. It is and has produced this epicenter of financial international finance capital in New York City. And I just want to read to you what some of the stuff that was said at the turn of the century in terms of these folks. Now, in 1929, in 1929, really, this was after the crash the 1929 Regional Plan of New York City and its environment put forth a vision for New York City that called for massive deindustrialization for the express purpose of getting rid of the city's blue-collar workforce. The city blue-collar industry would be replaced with luxury apartments, office buildings, department stores, and expansions of hospitals and universities. And that is exactly what is happening in New York City. When you look at the expansion of Columbia University, a $5 billion, $5 to $6 billion project that is to that will be developed in West Harlem. 18 acres, we have the expansion of NYU, we have the expansion of Cornell University that is taking over Roosevelt Island, it is moving into East Harlem. The mop-up stage will produce a decline in the black population that within 10 years, I predict, Harlem 60% black population will be reduced to 50 or 40%. That is the accelerated rate of this forced migration to the South, where this picture perfect, this rosy propaganda that we are receiving about blacks going to the South means absolutely nothing, because what we don't hear about are the poor and the working class in the South who live below the federal poverty line, and that is excluded from the narrative of prosperity, and blacks who are being forced out of the inner city, being part of this smokescreen, this rosy cover of them voluntarily returning to the South, living in huge homes and enjoying the good life. It is a lie, for in fact, we are all under the gun of gangster capitalism. And until, and hopefully in this conference with Black is Back, we will begin to strategize to reverse this trend, to reverse this political paradigm, and truly have a political end game of empowerment and principle politics that does not follow the Obama apologists, which is clearly not a path for us if we are truly talking about self-determination and black empowerment. Power to the people.
Thank you so much, Sister Conrad Nellie Bailey. So at this time, we're going to open it up for discussion. We're going to reduce the amount of time that we originally had for the discussion to make room for lunch. But for the next 5 minutes or so, we're going to be we're going to open it up, open the floor up for discussion. So if anybody in the audience has any contributions. Also, as the chairman said earlier in this program, one of our goals is to come out of this process with resolutions. And so if there's any contributions that one may want to give during the Q&A process or discussion, if you want to offer up what you feel should be a resolution, that's more than welcome as well.
So I just had some comments and maybe that could lead to a question. I'm going to be pretty brief. But when Glenn was up there and he brought to me some correlations that we saw, and just in reference to the chairman and what he said too. Well, as a secretary of Black is Back Coalition, and it's imperative, and I'm going to push it, that we should definitely figure out a way that we all can be working toward an agenda to that. Just like the chairman had referenced, that POP, who had a 381-day campaign, is not just something that is taken up in North, but also is being taken up everywhere that we are. But that really, when you were talking about the electoral, the mayors and everything begging for capital for white folks to come back to the city, we can see at this thing, the same thing is happening even on the continent of Africa, where we have these new growth initiatives and economic growth initiatives that are being put forth. However, we're asking the oppressors, the former colonizers, to come back into Africa to use their money in order for us to gain some resources and get, you know, back on the capitalist money market. And that's really significant, that if we want to, I think that we can be here and show an example of that, even within Washington, D.C., where we have a microcosm of, I think, everything. We have different groups dealing with different issues that on different levels, and the importance of a coalition that can bring all those groups together so that we can not just work as separate entities, but work together in order to make something larger. And so that people aren't dealing with different groups, different interest groups, but they're dealing with one body, which can be formed within the Black is Back Coalition, and that's where I see its presence. And I also had one comment about Nelly, and you're talking about the removal of Black people in New York City, and I just wanted to just pinpoint Park Slope, which I saw a movie in like the late 70s, early 80s, and Park Slope was a disaster. It was just like really low income, and now it's primarily white, and now they're moving up Flatbush Avenue with the development there as well. So I think that in Washington, D.C., where I'm from, where I live also, the complete gentrification of the Black population there as well, with a removal of pretty much one side of the river where mostly all the Black people live, and pushing them into PG County, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., but it's in Maryland. And this is really significant that it's not happening in just here or there, that it's happening all over, and that a coalition that brings all these issues together is what's really going to win and organize the people. Uhuru.
Greetings. My name is Charles Jones, and I'm a community activist. The presentation that both presenters gave was very informative. Basically, from the brother, Mr. Ford. My question is, you talked about the Black bourgeoisie. My question is, in your analysis, is there any value that the Black bourgeoisie can aid the formation or the struggle in the Black community? And if so, how would they be of value to talking about the black bourgeoisie? How can they be of value to their people who aspire to be bourgeoisie? I mean, it seems like you have a new generation that wants to reach the level or the position that the Black bourgeoisie is on. So if the majority of Blacks and poor minorities aspire to follow in the footsteps of Black bourgeoisie that's in the position right now, how can the Black bourgeoisie be of aid to change the mindset of our people that would that would give meaning to what we're struggling for?
Nelly and I had a conversation about this subject just yesterday, and I'm glad to address that. But when we use this word bourgeoisie and petty bourgeoisie, let's say petty bourgeoisie, we need to be careful about what we're talking about. In terms of the Black community, the petty bourgeois, the small business owner, the nightclub owner, the store owner, that class has almost ceased to exist. We live in the age that is marked by corporate consolidation, that big corporations own every damn thing, including everything on the main thoroughfares of black neighborhoods, as Nellie was talking about, on 125th and all those other thoroughfares. The folk who we might be calling petty bourgeoisie are usually corporate operatives. They're working directly for corporations. They're not small business folk. The closest one could get would be someone who has a McDonald's franchise, but that means he's an extension of McDonald's. He's not an independent petty bourgeois entrepreneur. But what we see is that if we were trying to build a black city to accommodate our people's ambitions in terms of business, we would have to protect those petty bourgeois aspiring business owners from the corporations. Otherwise, they'd be eaten alive. So when we use this term, let's not imagine the old definition of the store owner or barbershop owner, etc. Let's talk about who these guys really are. And they're people who work for the big corporation. They're people who front for Prudential. They're people who have already thrown their lot in with these multinational companies like McDonald's, etc.
So we're going to have to, you want to respond to that as well?
I just want to say pretty quickly, I totally agree with Glenn. What we're talking about is a black managerial class. They have no clout, they have no power. And if, in fact, they were in charge of a black institution, I'll give you a quick example. Carver National Bank, which used to be the oldest black bank in the country and certainly in New York. Well, it no longer is because they gave out these loans and at the height of the real estate boom in Harlem, and then those loans to blacks mostly, those loans were defaulted on. And so now who has Carver Bank? Wall Street. That's who has Carver Bank. And in Harlem, and I'm sure that this Harlem serves as a microcosm for other communities, if you look at every major cultural institution in Harlem, you know who heads up their board of directors? The Harlem Chamber of Commerce is chair is in fact a white businessman who doesn't even live in the community. That is how tight the control is. And let me just reference this brother who's no longer with us. I mean, his book gets a little bit. But Mamadou Chinlele wrote a book, Harlem Ain't Nothing But a Third World Country. Well, some of the facts in the book were wrong, but he was right on target with that title. And that's what it is. It is a plantation. And the oligarchy in New York City are even tired of their faithful servants. Look how they went after Rangel. Rangel was a crook for 41 years. He had those four apartments for over 20 years. Everybody knew that, but they tired of him. And he thought he was a member of the club, but he was not. And that's the way it is. And that's why the New York City oligarchy has bestowed respectability on charlatan Al Sharpton.
We're going to have to move the program forward because we do have lunch. We want to serve that. Before we do go into that, though, we want to make sure that we have a resolution, a proposed resolution coming out of this workshop right here. So we did hear a statement from the floor from Secretary Aisha in the form of a resolution. So I just want to make sure that we get that worded, you know, in a way that we would like for it to be proposed during the plenary. And there will be more time during the plenary itself to ask more questions and to flesh out this discussion. So if Aisha, maybe you want to restate that proposal as you do other announcements. So that concludes this workshop right here. Uhuru.
So I want to thank Nellie Bailey and Glenn Ford for their presentations. If you could give them all a round of applause again. I have I have to put together my resolution a little shorter shorter way, and then I can bring that to the plenary discussion this afternoon. But at this time, we are going to break for lunch. And lunch is being served at the back there. And please break also to visit our tables that are around the room. Up until now, we have not had a chance to really visit. And lunch is going to be served in the back, and it's $10 for a meal and a drink to support the caterer who has come out today. And if we can reconvene again at 2, what time is it now? In an hour. Are we going to have an hour for lunch, Rich? Rich, are we going to do an hour for lunch?